Blog Talk Radio.
The special technique. Special technique of shadow boxing.
Williams,
you know, going through a lot of those things. And one of the things that, you know, that I didn't know in the late 90s was that when I was in high school, there was a, we had a dean there, and the dean's name was Alonzo Johnson. And if you look over the course of Muhammad Ali's boxing career, he did fight a guy named Alonzo Johnson, and that person eventually became the dean of Rickards High School, which is the school that I went to from 1995-1999, and he was there in Tallahassee, and of course, Tallahassee is one of those, you know, places where you have a lot of a few boxers that came out of there that eventually made the professional ranks, notably heavyweight Travis Walker, who we interviewed on this show a few months earlier, and Tavoris Cloud, who, you know, is a light heavyweight who won a you know, eventual belt. So let's see if I could get the guest on here. Area code 205, you're on with me. What's going on with you?
What's going on, James? It's Mike Grady, man. How you doing?
Hey there, brother Mike. Just getting in here and, you know, just starting to talk about the news of the passing of Muhammad Ali Friday night. And I was just going through how, you know, Muhammad Ali, you know, was, you know, a little effect on my life, and I was just going into it. Like I was just saying there, you know, one of the, I mean, the dean that was in my high school was a boxer back in the day, and he had an eventual fight with Muhammad Ali early in Muhammad Ali's career. So I was just going through all that. And, of course, you know, looking at the whole thing with the Sports Century specials that they had on ESPN and ESPN Classic, that kind of got me all caught up with the career of Muhammad Ali. And I was just going to continue there, you know, just going forward. You know, he was basically, you know, one of the, you know, motivations for me to follow the sport of boxing. I mean, of course, you know, we came up during the time of, you know, Mike Tyson, Evander Holyfield, Riddick Bowe, and Lennox Lewis. But those guys were all, you know, inspired by the career of Muhammad Ali. So, if real quick, what is there anything you would like to say about, you know, the career of Muhammad Ali, and if there was anything about him that affected you over the course of your life?
Yeah, I mean, everybody already knows, you know, the effect that he had on the sport, and you know, just seeing what he did inside the ring with the measurables and intangibles that he had, and how he captivated the audience, it, you know, it was a beautiful thing to watch. And, you know, instead of just watching the Ali movies and stuff, actually going and watching those fights and, you know, seeing how actually it played out in comparison to the movies' representation of it. You know, it was good to go back and see fights of his. And, you know, one thing that I will say that I think kind of touched me a little bit about it, you know, while it's very presumptuous to say that him getting hit so much kind of contribute to his later decline in life, you know, it just kind of speaks to me. If I had a son that actually went into boxing, as much as I enjoyed, you know, his life and how he tried to captivate the audience, I just, you know, I would probably stay away from doing it at the expense of oneself. You know, like, I loved him. But I just, you know, some of his fights, I was like, man, you know, watching him, like, wow, you know, he put his heart and mind, and, you know, just, I mean, he was fast enough to do it, but, ooh, you know, it's just what people do to captivate the audience, you know, like them old gladiators and stuff. You got to just take your hat off to the man.
Right. And I mean, like, yeah, over the, you know, last two fights that he had over the course of his career, I mean, you had the, you know, the fights with the, you know, the young Leon Spinks there, and, you know, where he, you know, kind of lost the title and then regained the title. He could have, you know, retired then, but then and you know, they had the his fight there against Larry Holmes, and you know, even before that fight, you know, people were seeing signs that he was on the decline physically and mentally. So it was almost like, well, yeah, they wanted to go through with the fight, but you know, it wasn't really, you know, safe for him to actually go through it. You know what I mean? Because you know,
yeah,
that could, you know, eventually, you know, further damage him on the physical level. You know, so for him to go through that and even go through, you know, one or two fights after that, may have, you know, also accelerated the process, because, you know, there's some reports that said that he already had, you know, signs of Parkinson's before his career ended. So I think that, you know, that kind of like compounded things. But with the sport and boxing in general, it's just about, you know, I would say, you know, if you really have a feel for it, then you can go ahead and do it. You just got to know what the dangers are of it. It's a dangerous sport, just like football is a dangerous sport. And, of course, you know how the sport of football has changed over the course of just 5 years in the matter of safety concerns. So they have the same thing here with boxing. And it could affect the sport there as well.
Yeah, I definitely appreciate that they are, you know, mindful to not let people get bludgeoned, you know, as much as we as the crowd want to see it, you know. I really, you know, like when I see like a rock'em sock'em fight with people getting, you know, killed and blood coming out their nose and mouth and stuff, I just kind of, you know, don't get me wrong, I like it because, you know, the competitor to me, but I'm like, dang, this happening to a real person, they getting,
right,
you know, touch like that. It's, you know, it's not supposed to, that's not supposed to happen, you know.
I'll be getting into you know, one fight that happened over this weekend later on in this show, but when you talk about like, yeah, these people that go back and forth at it, and how it could affect them in the long term, and how, you know, they're able to put themselves all on the line for that, there's also, you know, those cases where, you know, you gotta be mindful of what's happening inside the ring too, because I mean, we've already went through, what was it, last year, when they had a fight over here in the Virginia area with you know, Pressure Cologne. I mean, Pressure Cologne was, you know, he was a pretty good fighter when he was you know, out there, and I mean, he was just going through, you know, going through the fight, but he knew that something was, you know, going wrong with him while he was fighting his opponent, and the referee just, you know, let it go on, and, you know, all of a sudden, you know, those complications from those fights, that fight, had him be in a coma, and he, you know, the family's still dealing with it to this day. The last report that I got from, you know, Matthew Long here through the Cohort Truth on Sports, that he was back in with his family after being in Nova Hospital here in Virginia, and then going down to Atlanta. Now he should be, they say he's in Florida, you know, dealing with, he's with his family now in Florida. So, I mean, that's something there where they're not sure if he's going to be able to fully recover from those complications. So, it's like you said, you know, with your son, it's something that you have to think about. This is a very dangerous sport that, you know, could, you know, cause, you know, long-term damage to those that, you know, don't, you know, either don't take it seriously or, you know, not very, you know, not taking it safe all the way through.
Yeah. And I'm not trying to make it about Floyd Mayweather, but people give him a bad rap for how he supposedly fights, but, you know, him thinking about how his uncle has deteriorated, and I'm sure he probably has seen plenty of other guys too. You know, that's just, you know, people don't think about it that, you know, yeah, you put your life on the line for the sport and you want to make money, but it's real, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It was, it was like something. I wish I could have to remember something that Gabriel Rosado said about, you know, how boxers get in the ring and how, you know, they put everything out on the line once they're in the ring, and fans really enjoy that they put themselves, you know, out there, put their lives on the line. But when everything is said and done and they're not fighting anymore, it's like, you know, where are those fans at? You know, so it's just something there where, you know, you gotta be, you know, attentive of, you know, where these guys are at once they hang them up. You know what I mean?
Yeah, because we as fans definitely like, what have you done for me lately type attitudes.
Yeah. But going back to, you know, Muhammad Ali and his legacy inside the ring, I mean, a lot of people, you know, kind of point to, you know, the fights that he had, especially, you know, during the 70s when they had the likes of Joe Frazier, George Foreman, Ken Norton, Ernie Chavis, Ron Lyle, and the like during the course of that career. And a lot of those guys are, you know, widely considered among the top 20, 25 heavyweights of all time. And he was able to, you know, have a winning record against those guys. So that's why, you know, a lot of people, you know, put Muhammad Ali as, you know, top five or maybe top three boxers of all time under, you know, the likes of, you know, Sugar Ray Robinson and others. You know, my thing is, I'm not necessarily sure if we're going to, you know, see a heavyweight up to the level of Muhammad Ali. You know, skill-wise, for one, and the way that he marketed himself. I mean, he was basically, you know, the first big box office, you know, fighter. He was the very first box office fighter. I mean, you had that first fight between Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier, and while that was, you know, kind of like on, I would say, either regular or closed-circuit television, you did have, you know, Muhammad Ali's fight against George Foreman, which was pretty much the, you know, first, I would say the first fight that had a million-dollar purse. So, I mean, he was involved in, you know, the movement to get from, you know, to get boxing from being on regular TV to being on, you know, premium cable, and then eventually on pay-per-view. So, I mean, he's had many different impacts on the sport, whether he's, you know, been in the ring fighting these big guys or the overall business of the sport.
But yeah, I agree. I don't think that will be a heavyweight like that like could move and, you know, pretty much have the speed of a, you know, I guess this is very subjective, but the speed of like a middleweight or something. There, you probably won't see that guy no time soon. And who can be as fluid as him, you know, move on his feet, be as fluid as him, you know. Yeah, you got to be special to be able to do a lot of the stuff that he did.
Yeah, I mean, especially around this time now, because, you know, now, I mean, I would say that Muhammad Ali, during his time, he was around, you know, 6'3", 215 to 220 pounds as a heavyweight. And, you know, nowadays you have guys that are, you know, 6'5", 6'6", 6'7", that are around, you know, 240 to 250 pounds in there fighting. So, I mean, you won't necessarily have, you know, those 6'3", 215 guys out there unless they're at cruiserweight. And, or if you have somebody the likes of, I would say, maybe
Wilder.
The Wilder's a bit too large. I'm trying to compare it to Ali's size, but to me, I only see, like, cruiserweights being around that range, like a Steve Cunningham. Would probably fit the body mold of what Muhammad Ali was back in the 70s, being a heavyweight, you know. So I don't necessarily think that there's going to be a heavyweight that's going to be able to do that. Maybe if there's like anyone else around this modern era that would probably be close or that was close is David Haye. David Haye was pretty much around that size. I think when he won one version of the heavyweight championship before, he lost to Vladimir Klitschko and had that 4-year layoff before his two sets of fights that he's had this year. Yeah, so. Just real quick here, we are here on the Boxing Source Radio Show Live. Number to dial in is 347-237-5539. Once again, it is 347-237-5539. Press one key to get on queue, and you'll be able to talk live on the show. All right, yeah, just, you know, getting back into this thing here with Muhammad Ali. And I mean, for me, it's kind of like different because there have been times when, you know, I would like, you know, as many boxing fans have, is imitate Muhammad Ali and, you know, imitate his voice, imitate his moves and stuff like that. There was one story when this was like a few years ago when I was in Tampa, and I was like in University Mall. And I'm sure that this store clerk wasn't you know, aware of who Muhammad Ali was, because there was like a Muhammad Ali shirt in the store. And I went up and I ended up getting that shirt. And then I walked up to the store clerk and the face of the shirt and then looked at me and then asked, "Is this you?" And I was like, "Nah, man, nah, nah." So
is what true now?
Almost like, huh?
What did they ask was true?
The face that was on the shirt of Muhammad Ali was me. Because they almost thought that I looked like the same, had the same face as what was on the shirt. Which I thought was, like, kind of funny, because I was like, nah, I didn't want to necessarily, you know, imitate Muhammad Ali that much, man. And I wasn't like, you know, that clean shaven. I can't really get to that level, you know. So I just kind of like found it a little bit funny, but it almost like, you know, gets to almost the length of like how, you know, I kind of like followed the career and the life of Muhammad Ali, and you know, he had, you know, those moments where he was, you know, inside the ring, but he became, you know, one of the most famous and notable people in the world for what he was doing outside of the ring, especially during those times in the 60s and 70s, especially when they were going out, when he refused to be drafted into the United States Armed Forces, and especially the thing with Vietnam. And That's one of the controversial things about him and why he was a polarizing figure, you know, outside of the sport. And the thing about that is like, even if he was able to, you know, be in there, he might have been there in a limited capacity because, you know, Joe Louis was also, you know, registered in the armed forces during the course of his career, but I mean, he had, you know, a couple of exhibition fights here and there while he was enlisted. But Muhammad Ali was one that was a staunch opponent of the war, number one, and he didn't, you know, feel like there was anything that, you know, the Vietnamese there did in order to make him, you know, go out there for war or go out to support the war. And, you know, I think that was one of the most, you know, poignant parts of his life because he stood for what he believed was, you know, just in that instance. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, kind of like, you know, hated him for it. And the funny thing is that, you know, there may be a good amount of people that are, you know, still out, you know, still alive today that remember that time. And at that time, they were not necessarily down with what he said. So it's kind of, like, interesting to me how, you know, how at this point, you know, Muhammad Ali is, you know, one of the most beloved individuals in the world when, you know, back in that time, he was, you know, the most polarizing figure in the world because either you really liked him or you really hated him.
Yeah, and to your point, you know, it's kind of, it comes full circle. Like you said, at the time, you know, it was controversial, him denouncing, you know, the involvement in the war. But I imagine if you asked a lot of vets, you know, their opinion of the war, it would be, you would get some very tossed up opinions about the war, you know, just with everything and how it was at least portrayed in the history books and, you know, stuff like that. So I'm saying that maybe nowadays, like as if you're saying, like, maybe people may or may not agree with him nowadays. Maybe not to the extent,
yeah,
but, you know.
Yeah, not to the extent. And I mean, it's one of the most, one of the more interesting things though with me, because I mean, I know people that served in the armed forces during that time. I mean, I have relatives that served in the armed forces during that time. And for me, when it comes to, you know, doing things like that, going into war, that's like something that I just couldn't imagine myself doing, because the after effects of being in war or something like that, war, depending on like how involved you were in it, it lasts for the rest of your life. It affects you for the rest of your life, you know. So, I mean, it's something to you know, kind of consider when, you know, Ali was thinking about, you know, what was happening there in Vietnam, one, and the whole thing about what's happening here in the States. I mean, he felt that, you know, why would he go out there to do something, you know, to fight for a country that wouldn't even fight for him in his own homeland, you know? So it's like, what's the point? And people call him, like, traitor or, you know, backstabber for saying that or anything like that. But, I mean, to me, I mean, he was basically telling the truth. I mean, there's, you know, instances where, I mean, if his brother or his cousin or something like that, you know, was, you know, mistreated by, you know, a policeman or somebody out there, and there's no one out there, you know, there's no authority to protect them, then why would he go out to fight for something that kind of symbolizes that? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. And the crazy thing about that, though, is that, you know, depending on your perspective, you get a different view of the same situation. So, you know, to say one man's perception is wrong or unjust or something, It's kind of very, you know, it's not fair to anyone, because, you know, your perception and view of the same situation can be totally different. So, you know, everybody probably has merit in what they believe. And, you know, there's something that makes them feel what they believe.
Right. Right. And, I mean, that was just, you know, one example of, you know, one of the things that, you know, he kind of like stood up for over the course of his career. And one of the other things was, you know, after his career, pretty much like after his career, he was, you know, of course, deeply involved in the Islamic faith and, you know, taught, you know, the practices of, you know, Islam and everything like that. And, you know, one of the things that was pointed out, you know, about what he was saying is they had the whole thing with the 9/11 situation and how, you know, a lot of people reacted to, you know, Muslims and that how, you know, in the knee-jerk reaction that, you know, people were blaming all Muslims for, you know, what was happening there during that time. And he basically said that, you know, Islam, true Islam stood for peace. So, you know, anyone who actually did that, you know, over in New York and over in the Pentagon and, you know, out there in Pennsylvania, that was not Islam. That doesn't embody Islam, you know. And, you know, almost at the same token, it's hard for people to kind of like point something like that towards Islam when, you know, you've had, you know, other atrocities that have been tied to, you know, other religious beliefs. So you can't really, you know, pin one thing down for, you know, one religion when you can't even take in the atrocities that have happened over the course of history from another religion.
Yeah, I actually was watching a news coverage, and so they were talking about like these mass shootings, and it kind of like just baffles me, you know. Like I'm not saying either way against it, but you know, when people appear to do the mass shootings and they appear to be Christian or something like that, they say, you know, mass shooting, and then it seems like the one who's of a different face, they call it terrorism.
Right.
And I'm not saying it is or isn't terrorism, but, you know, just the stigma that, you know, let's say if you're from the majority faith, they say mass shooting, terrible event, and then if you're from another faith, even if it is a mass shooting, a terrible event, they call it terrorism, you know. Maybe I need to look up the definition of it to see, you know, the difference in both, but
right.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I don't know.
And,
I think. Go ahead.
Oh, what you
were
saying?
Well, I was just saying, like, on that whole people downing other people, like, I feel like if everybody had an opportunity I saw something like a documentary where people traced their heritage, and, you know, before they traced their heritage, they had an affinity against XYZ group, but after they traced their heritage, they were like, dang, I have family ties that are part of this group. And then it made people a little bit less, you know, like it made it a less of a stigma to like all other people who aren't similar to you. And, you know, just experiencing different people's cultures and stuff like that. You know, the more you're educated and you actually are educated in other people's differences, you know, the better you are to appreciate them.
Right, right, and the thing is that, you know, I mean, you know, people who took time to, you know, reflect on history of, you know, their people and, you know, their, you know, religious beliefs or faiths or followings, then, you know, they would get a better understanding of, you know, why things are what they are, you know, so... I think that, you know, is kind of something that, you know, is a notable reflection of, you know, how Muhammad Ali lived his life. Because, I mean, he was like, you know, one of the embodiments of, you know, how to carry yourself regardless of what your faith is or who you are, you know. Because, I mean, he you know, he himself went through a lot. You know, over the course of his amateur career through the Olympics, you know, winning the gold medal and, you know, still being discriminated against, still, you know, victim of racism and things like that. And, you know, he was still, you know, still able to go through the course of his boxing career and win the heavyweight championship 3 times during his career, you know. I was trying to see if there was like something else that I would point out. You know, one of the things that, you know, a lot of the people that are within the age range of, I'd say, 20, maybe 20 to 40. No, let me see. Let me trace back. Nah, it wouldn't even be 20. It would probably be 30, like around our age. I would say around 30 to 45, It's kind of like coming to the – well, we know that the Olympics are coming up here soon in a couple of months. And, you know, 20 years ago, the Olympics was in Atlanta. And, of course, you had the, you know, lighting ceremony of the Olympic flame in Atlanta. And, you know, one of the, you know, most notable moments over that, you know, the past 20, 25 years was, you know, to see the, you know, the last person to, you know, receive the Olympic flame before, you know, went up to the torch that was up there in the Olympic Village in Atlanta was Muhammad Ali. And so I think a lot of people, you know, kind of like remember that as one of their poignant moments of seeing Muhammad Ali in a large scale or basically on TV. Were you able to catch that when that happened?
No, I don't remember it like personally, but I watched it like, you know, after the fact, like as a grown up, I watched it. Is that what you mean by that? Like, did I catch it when I was 20 years ago? Did I catch it?
Yeah.
No, I didn't. I wasn't, you know, that big into much stuff. I didn't catch it way back when, but I saw it like, you know, as an adult.
Gotcha. Yeah, I think because I think that was, you know, one of the you know, moments, because there is you know, as a boxing fan, I mean, there was still, you know, a couple of guys that were still out there during the time that Muhammad Ali was out. I mean, you still had Larry Holmes was at, you know, around the tail end of his career. George Foreman was at the tail end of his career when he, like, was able to win the heavyweight championship again in around, like, 1994 or so. I mean, you still had, you know, a couple of guys that are around that era that, you know, some people may have known from back then, but they still didn't have the overall effect that Muhammad Ali had. So seeing him there in Atlanta was probably, you know, one of the greatest moments in Olympic history, or at least Olympic modern-day history. All right. I'll just basically close out with that segment there and, you know, get into – you know, live or the actual boxing here. Once again, folks, the number to dial in to get in here live for the Boxing Source Radio Show is 347-237-5539. Once again, 347-237-5539. Press one key to get on cue, and you'll be able to talk live on the show. All right. Now, just getting into the boxing that happened over the, you know, over last weekend or on Saturday. On HBO, they had a main event there between Francisco Vargas and Orlando Salido. And that main event that they had there was a very good back and forth fight, I think, but it was something that, you know, we kind of, you know, expected out of both of these guys, especially with Orlando Salido. Salido has been in with a lot of notable fighters. Of course, he was the guy that was able to give Vasyl Lomachenko his only loss of his career so far. He's fought Mikey Garcia. He's fought Juan Manuel Lopez a couple of times. He's fought Yurioka Scamboa, Rocky Martinez. So he's fought, you know, the who's who, even fought Robert Guerrero back in 2006. And also Juan Manuel Marquez. So if there's anybody that's fought a who's who in the course of the lower divisions, there is Orlando Salido with, you know, 60 fights within his career. And so he went up there, you know, to go up against Vargas, who was the WBC super featherweight champion, you know, who just won it over Takashi Miura in a fight of the year there back in November of 2015. So, you know, it was a, you know, a notable fight. People were expecting this one to be an extremely back and forth fight, and they did not disappoint you from like round two, from rounds one and two to round 12. There were a lot of notable rounds in there, specifically round three and I think round eight, where they were just, you know, hitting each other with big shots back and forth, back and forth. And, you know, we couldn't necessarily tell who had the upper hand at any point of the fight. And so, you know, once those 12 rounds did go through, it ended up being a majority draw with two judges giving it a draw and one, giving it 115-113 to Vargas. So Vargas was able to retain the WBC version of the Super Featherweight Championship. And, you know, after this fight, a lot of people are seeing that they would rather see Salido fight Vargas again than for Vasyl Lomachenko to get another shot at Orlando Salido. So what you got to say on this particular fight? Able to get it.
Yeah, I thought it was a very good fight, as you said, very back and forth. You know, it was the typical fan-friendly match that just the casual fan would definitely love. Something that I agree with the announcers, like announcers kind of kill me in that, you know, they seem to always have an agenda, and then they just push that agenda the whole night, and so pretty much if you're listening and you're not watching the fight, you're thinking that, you know, wow, you know, this is actually happening. And you know, for the most part, it was a pretty even fight. I think, like, I was giving the nod to Salido, especially late in the fight. I didn't score the fight, but, I mean, I wasn't against it being a draw because it was definitely a good fight. But yeah, he tends to for him not to have, or seemingly not have, as much talent as Vargas. It seems like he gets everybody into the fight that he wants them to fight, and I guess it's a testament to how good he is that he can get them into the exact fight that he has the best chance of winning. Even though I think that, you know, I ask myself, how long is he gonna last fighting like this? Because, you know, he never, like, just take it easy, you know. He always in the phone booth type fighting, and, you know, like, I didn't count too many times where like 5 or 6 seconds went where they wasn't swinging their arms. So it was a very high-paced fight. And, you know, Salido seems to get everybody in the fight that he wants them to have, even with people who seem to be more skilled than him. But as far as Lomachenko or Vargas again, oh no, I think either fight would be a good fight. You know, the excuse that Lomachenko has, it was his first fight. He probably wasn't used to that style. Granted, I do think that if he fought him again, he would be more boxing-ish. You know, he would definitely try to stay moving backwards and trying to fight boxing. But I think Salido has the tools to put enough pressure on him to make him, you know, get uncomfortable. So I think definitely the Vargas fight would be more interesting, but, you know, I think the Lomachenko fight would be the tactical, you know, boxer versus, you know, come forward type fighter, the matador versus the boxer type fight. But yeah, fan friendly, I definitely think Vargas would be the best one.
Yeah, I think you know, a lot more people would be attracted to, you know, Vargas Salido too, because, you know, they know that, you know, it would be a, you know, a fighter versus a fighter, you know, going back and forth one on one instead of a boxer going up against a fighter in Orlando Salido. Alito that has had a, you know, good number of fights under his belt now since fighting Vasily Lomachenko. He's had, you know, four fights since his fight against Lomachenko on March 1st of 2014. And they've been all, you know, very tough fights, especially, you know, the two with, you know, Roman Marquez Martinez and here with Francisco Vargas. So, you know, if Lomachenko goes up against Alito now, it'd probably be a lot different result here against Alito, because I think that Lomachenko will be able to make more adjustments, and I think he's a lot – I wouldn't necessarily say he's a lot better fighter now, but – you know, he's had, you know, a good number of fights here that he's, you know, become better at. And, you know, notably with Lomachenko, I mean, he's about to fight here on Saturday against Roman Martinez. So we're going to be seeing him, you know, going up against, you know, the guy that fought Toledo twice, two very close and very good fights. So, this could be, you know, generally a barometer to see if, okay, if he's going to basically do very well against Martinez, it may not be necessarily good to, you know, match Orlando Salido up with Vasily Lomachenko here at this point, and rather just get the, you know, more fan-friendly, more attractive fight with Salido and Vargas once again. So that might be the route to go for Orlando Salido there, because that way he may, you know, still have a shot at the at a belt once again.
Yeah. I agree. But speaking of, I'm sorry if I'm going off a tangent here, but speaking of, like, the people having their own agenda, did you watch the Shane Mosley card? I just felt like there was an agenda in that card, which kind of disappointed me a little bit.
Well, the one last week, I wasn't able to catch that, you know, that previous one last week. But, you know, the thing there with Shane Mosley and David Avsenian, you know, that the result of that fight, as you know, was to basically become the number one contender to the WBA welterweight championship. But yeah. Was there, like, anything else that was that you noticed or that you wanted to point out?
Yeah, so the announcers for the card were, I think it was Zab Judah, and I forgot who the other guys were, but nevertheless, it's like the whole time, you know, Shane Mosley was pretty much getting beat to the punch the whole time. You know, he wasn't really throwing his hands for real. And so it's like every time he did something, it was like it was a Pacquiao fight where they were just like, you know, oh, Shane Mosley, you know, this and that, you know, excuse me, let me dome Shane Mosley up, you know, just it's so crazy, you know. And so at the end of the fight, I was like, oh, my gosh, you know, they're about to take this title away from, you know, the guy who was actually winning. And it was just, I don't know, it just was so much like the whole while, it was just like the Pacquiao-Bradley fight where they were like, oh, Pacquiao landed 60 punches, and, you know, you only seen him really throw two. It's just like they had an agenda. And I know that was Shane Mosley's card, so maybe that was the agenda, that in that it was his card that he was promoting. But the same thing happened with his son, too, in my opinion, where they were like, you know, kind of big up in his son when he probably shouldn't have been big up. You know, and I don't know, his son, let me be careful with my words. I'm just going to say what I really feel. His son looked kind of soft in his fight, if you ask me. His son looked kind of soft in the fight. But they were still saying stuff along the lines of like, oh, you know, his son did this and did that, and, you know, the son ended up winning like a majority decision or split decision or something. But when I saw, I missed the first two rounds, I'll say, but the last few rounds that I saw, he was getting, you know, bullied and getting touched up and stuff. You know, yeah, the guy was cruel, but he still was hitting him, you know. And it was just like the Mosley show. And I just was like, this kind of is an atrocity. And then the announcers were like, the worst they can see it is a tie. And then Shane Moses who wins, the worst they can see it was a tie. But they ended up giving him the fight, as you know. But I just thought it was going to be some another BS decision in boxing.
Yeah, I mean, there it shows as a result that Shane Mosley Jr. got a majority decision over Roberto Young. And, I mean, Roberto Young was coming in the ring there with the losing record. So, I mean, you know, Mosley Jr. Should have been able to do what he was, you know, do what he's supposed to do in order to get through guys like that. But it seems here that, yeah. Seems like, you know, what you were seeing, that he was getting bullied a lot.
Very much so.
You know, within that ring. And, I mean, and actually, he is a super middleweight. So, I mean, he's there, you know, the mix of 168. So, I mean, if he can't, you know, basically hang at 168, he won't be able to, you know, get there in the ranks of, you know, the higher guys that are up there, at least, you know, for the time being right now.
Yeah, I definitely think they need to go
strong with him. Yeah. If he's having those type of weaknesses against guys that, you know, that aren't, you know, very, you know, aren't very good on paper, then there's no way that he's going to be able to, you know, get through the guys that are like, you know, middle of the pack.
And I can see him getting knocked out if he ever stepped up like that.
Yep. All right. So just moving on here before we get to, you know, a little bit of the overtime portion of the show. There was like another set of fights going on, actually. There was a card on HBO, which, you know, I knew about. But, you know, admittedly, I did not know that there was a PBC on ESPN card that happened late last night over in Canada. And this this one here, the main event involved the light heavyweight that they have out there that's also from Russia. You have Kovalev there that is, you know, one of the, you know, top-ranked guys out there. And the other guy that comes from the Russia area is Artur Beterbiev. And, you know, those that know about Beterbiev, he was the one that had defeated Kovalev twice in the amateur ranks. So a lot of people know about his skills there in the amateurs. And he, you know, already had like nine wins, nine knockouts, which included, you know, getting the wins over Tavoris Cloud to win a minor light heavyweight championship, and veteran Gabriel Campillo, he also defeated by knockout. So here he was in Montreal, Quebec, which is, you know, where he resides right now. He was able to fight at the Bell Center against Ezequiel Moderna. And I was like, you know, keeping an eye on that fight while, you know, watching the Vargas-Salido fight. And I could see, you know, right there, right in the beginning of that fight, that this is an obvious mismatch, that Beterbiev was basically, you know, there to toy around with Moderna. And in the second and third rounds, especially in the third and fourth, you know, Beterbiev was basically toying with him. And, you know, the knockdowns that were happening against Moderna, they weren't necessarily real knockdowns. Moderna didn't really get caught with any real shots. He just basically, you know, crumpled down after, you know, a minor shot, whether it was a jab or if he got caught, you know, with a hook while he was, you know, halfway blocking it, he was still going down. And the last knockdown, you know, Beterbiev basically threw two jabs and then a hook that didn't connect, but Moderna still went down anyway. And once he was down there on the canvas, he was just sitting down looking at his corner, waiting for them to throw the towel, or he was just going to sit there and take that whole 10 count because he didn't want to, either further damage himself or whatnot. But it was just an absolute mismatch. Beterbiev was able to, win again to retain his WBA for the NABA Light Heavyweight Championship. He's there as one of the, top contenders amongst the light heavyweight division, but they're trying to see if he's going to have another step-up fight within the light heavyweight division. Of course, you have Kovalev there that's on his way to fighting Andre Ward, but before he's fighting Andre Ward, he'll have a fight in Russia against Isaac Chalemba. So it'll be Kovalev against Chalemba, and if it gets through that, then he'll be fighting Andre Ward. There's other guys out there like Andre Fonfara, Alvarez are there in the in the light heavyweight division, and there's also a couple of guys out there like who Ward fought, Sullivan Barrera, are there at light heavyweight that, Beterbiev can fight in order to stay there amongst the higher ranks in the light heavyweight division. So what's your thoughts about, Beterbiev and how he fits in with the light heavyweights that are out there?
So I'm going to, since our boy World Ranking here, I'm going to say it in his immortal words. They ought to be ashamed of themselves for putting him in with this type of guy. I definitely, the guy didn't want to be in there. He waved his corner in there to, like, they had a miscommunication, and he, like, waved his hand, like, stop the damn fight, and then, they didn't see him. He was like, man, bring y'all butts in here and stop this fight. And yeah, it was very disappointing, actually, because I was flipping back and forth, too, and I was like, ain't this some crap, Like, I'm flipping, and, I'm watching this good fight, and then as soon as I forget to flip back over, which is only, like, a minute that done passed, the fight has already stopped. But I know they say that he beat Kovalev in the amateurs, but I just, me extrapolating what I see from the level of competition that he's fighting, I don't see him beating Kovalev. Like, maybe I need to see him more to where somebody brings more out of him so I can see what he really is made of, but I think Kovalev would beat this guy. I really do. I really think Kovalev, what Kovalev showed me in the Bernard Hopkins fight is that, he can fight moving backwards or moving forward. And, that in itself makes Kovalev very dangerous. And he got, the power to hurt anybody. Beterbiev has been hurt before, in his fights. He's been hurt before. And I'm not saying that Kovalev hadn't been hurt, but I just know Kovalev dominates the competition that you put him in front of. I guess I would like to see Beterbiev against like a Sullivan Barrera to see like where he's at, and then to see if Sullivan Barrera, should be where he's at too, or even a it's the guy who always gets hurt in his fight but end up knocking the people out, who fought Andre Ward, but he fought Andre Ward maybe 3 fights ago, but this guy always gets hurt. He always gets hurt in his fight, and he's like there to be hit. But every shot he throws is like a very powerful shot. I'm trying to think of this guy's name.
Smith. It was a couple of other guys. It was a couple of fights before that, right?
Yeah. So about 3 fights ago. Lumbumba. He got.
Oh,
like,
you mean like Chalemba?
Who?
But no, it wasn't Chalemba because he fought right. There's Rodriguez. He fought, like, Ward fought Rodriguez, and he fought
Rodriguez.
Jared Dawson. Okay,
that's what I'm talking about,
Rodriguez. Yeah.
Yeah, and his nickname, La Bamba or something?
Yeah, it might be. I think so.
Yeah. So I would like to see him fight Edwin Rodriguez, somebody who's there to be hit. But, when you see Edwin Rodriguez fight, he's trying to hurt you. He always gets hurt in all his fights. But, this will kind of let us know where he's at, you know, the level of fight that he should step up to, you know, even though this ain't really that much of a step up, so to say, it would just let us know if Berdabiev can handle this type of guy and you know, use the skills that he should use and just get him out there. But I think Rodriguez would touch him at least a few times, though.
That's true.
But, yeah, I don't see him beating Kovalev. I'm tossing it up whether or not he would beat a Stevenson. I'd have to, you know, watch Stevenson a little bit more, but I don't think he would beat Stevenson either.
Yeah, Stevenson is supposed to be en route to, I think it was fighting, who was the guy that they have here on the rankings? I thought it was, I think it was Thomas Williams that Stevenson is basically on his way to fighting next in the light heavyweight division. So, yeah, it is Thomas Williams. That'll be on July 16th when Stevenson fights Williams. So, yeah, I would like to see better be able to fight somebody like either Edwin Rodriguez or even a Andre Fonfar. I mean, that would be an even better fight.
Because
I mean,
Fonfar
has been there against basically anybody. Yeah, that's a definite possibility. Fonfar is that skilled enough to, you know, beat a guy the likes of you know, better be of in a professional fight. So I'm not necessarily also sure if someone like Al Haymon would put a guy, you know, like from far against better be a, you know. All right. We're just reaching the overtime portion here of the show here for the Boxing Source Radio Show. So we got like basically a couple of things here that we're going to basically point out over the course of this segment here. Of course, we all know about the fight card that's going to be at the Barclays Center on June 25th. But, you know, I wanted to move forward with, you know, kind of like this off-topic news here. Of course, over the past couple of weeks or so, we've been going through the whole thing with the rumor mill about Floyd Mayweather and his possibility of returning to the ring. And one of those potential fights that, you know, a lot of people were seeing if they were talking about in the fear, if it was possible, was see if there would be some type of matchup between him and Conor McGregor. But, well, during UFC 199 last night, he found out that Conor McGregor will basically return to the octagon on July 9th. To have a rematch against Nate Diaz. So we're going to be seeing Conor McGregor back into the octagon and not into the boxing ring with the rematch against Nate Diaz. So if we're, you know, expecting to see Floyd Mayweather back in the ring, it will not be against Conor McGregor. So all of those rumors that were floating around over the past few weeks, you know, are basically for not as of right now. But this is like something that I kind of surprised about because there was no, you know, no potential way that, you know, anyone would kind of like pull off a match between Floyd Mayweather and Conor McGregor. Although, you know, there would be a lot of buzz on it. I just kind of felt that it wasn't really going to take place. So what's your feelings on it?
Repeat it one more time. I was not paying attention. I'm so sorry.
No, the thing about, you know, Conor McGregor, you know, with the possibility of him, Floyd Mayweather, but that was not the case. As we know that now that, you know, Conor McGregor is going back to the Octagon, and he will be in the ring in UFC 202 against Nate Diaz once again. Solo,
yeah, I mean,
rumors about him being, you know, in the ring against Floyd Mayweather, that wasn't going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think he wouldn't do that to himself because, you know, there's a real possibility that Floyd might get his first exhibition knockout in a long time. You know, it ain't going to be no BS, what people may call some bullshit when he knocked out Ortiz. It would be a legitimate knockout, you know, to a guy who, you know, shouldn't be in a ring with a real boxer if you know, the other guy boxed him to sleep. If a UFC guy boxed him to sleep. So I'm kind of glad it didn't happen. I think that, yeah, if they wanted to make money, they could do exhibitions. And, you know, to that point, the old fighters used to do that, you know. Like, I know I saw a few things of George Foreman, you know, at least I saw one that he had a night where he fought five different guys. And it was an exhibition, don't get me wrong, but, you know, they were in there going for blows, though.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it could happen. You know, Floyd do an exhibition. They used to do it in the old days, so why not? Well, why not in that it would be a travesty and he would get knocked out, but, yeah, I'm just saying it could happen in that sense.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the thing about it is, I mean, it would only be basically like an exhibition to, you know, try to have those two guys like go at it during that time. So I don't see why, you know, anyone would actually, you know, go forward with a Floyd Mayweather, Conor McGregor type of fight. You know, so
I wouldn't see nobody like Spencer and men like that. They would definitely, you know, I guess it could be sanctioned in Vegas in that Floyd makes them a bunch of money. So never mind on my statement.
Well, I guess on that note, I'll basically see if I could close out this episode of the show. And we'll continue with the Boxing Source Radio Show here next Sunday, where we're probably going to be talking more about the welterweight fight between Keith Thurman and Sean Porter as it closely approaches us on June 25th. Be sure to catch our sister shows here on the MRN Broadcasting Channel as we have the Cold Hard Truth on Sports on Tuesday nights at 8:30 with the Executioner Matthew Morgan. The CNT Firestone Football Talk Show Wednesday at 8:30 hosted by Callie Mike. So as long as you're able to catch those shows and also catch the Boxing Source Radio Show here every week, you'll be able to catch up on the news and happenings within the sports world. So on that note, folks, I'll close this show like I close out every show. Point of boxing is to hit and not get hit, not to stand and trade. On that note, I'm out.